All right, welcome everyone. I am so glad to have you all here with me today in the Meet Your Mentor podcast. My name is Elise and I will be your host for today. As of right now, I'm a sophomore in high school and I'm interning here at the Mentor Project, which gives me the opportunity to talk to so many incredible people. As for this podcast, each week I'll be interviewing one of our world-renowned mentors and asking about their profession, maybe some advice they have for younger generations, what it means to be a mentor, and so much more. Quick shout out to our listeners and our sponsors for making this podcast possible. You guys are amazing. Now, whether you're coming back to the podcast or you're a new listener, I think you will love what we have in store for you today. I'm so excited to introduce you all to Matthew Griffin, the mentor I will be interviewing today. He is a futurist who works at the 311 Institute, which he founded. The 311 Institute is a consultancy that helps enterprises to elevate their products and companies based off of industry trends and popular ways to market these things. He also founded Futures Forums and X Potential University, which are two organizations that are dedicated to reducing global inequality and making sure people of all backgrounds and walks of life will be able to have access to the benefits of the future. Take it away. I'm so glad to have you here.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Elise. It's great to be here, albeit virtually, obviously.
Yeah. All right. Can you tell us a little bit about what futurism means and what like an average day at work looks like for you?
An average day at work. There's a fun one. We'll have that in a minute. So what futurism means? So a futurist essentially is somebody who actually looks at the future and tries to extrapolate out what has either happened in the past, happened today, to try to reasonably predict with some level of accuracy what's going to happen in a particular time frame. So vast majority of futurists, you'll typically find sort of work in the sort of the 5 to 10 year range. I actually work in the 50 year range.
Wow. So
I look at kind of two different types of futures. I look at what I call the future, which is 0 to 20 years out. And then I look at the deep future, which is sort of 20 to 50 years out. And the reason why I do that is because most multinational organizations kind of care more about the next sort of 20 years. You know, they slice that up depending on their sort of particular point of view. So most international organizations, it's like sort of 5, 10, 20 years, you know, where 20 years is kind of just a little bit of a fun exercise for them. But if you're a sovereign government, and I sort of work with all G20 governments, you care about the next 50 years, particularly when we start having a look at the future of, you know, the welfare state, the monetary system, financial services, you know, the economy, energy, infrastructure, education and skills, jobs, all that sort of stuff. And then in terms of my average day, and I'm sniggering for a variety of different reasons. So let's have a little chat about today. So today, basically, we've been having conversations with the United Nations, where we've been discussing how humans are increasingly being able to be turned into biological supercomputers. So if you wonder, again, this is all on the website and everything else. So
yeah,
so we've been talking about turning humans basically into biological supercomputers. We've been talking about the automation of jobs and work. Typically, most of my days basically involve things like molecular assemblers, talking about different exponential technologies. So, for example, that can be self-evolving artificial intelligences, AIs that are creative. You know, there's lots of people out there who don't think that artificial intelligence can copy human creativity. They're wrong. And I have videos to prove it, because everyone always likes proof. Other things we kind of talk about basically are today things like quantified self, the ability of artificial intelligence basically to ultimately help you become a healthier, fitter person, as well as coaching you. No day's the same. And then I'll end off the day basically with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where we'll be talking about, you know, traveling wave reactors basically in grid scale storage and, you know, global sanitation issues. So it literally goes everywhere.
I want to get back to the thing you said about AI mimicking like human creativity in a second, but it kind of sounds like you kind of do everything. So do you have like a specialty, or are your companies kind of all areas?
So we're all areas, you know, and the reason for that is if you have a look at if you have a look at society today, particularly from a sort of business perspective, you can really kind of boil everything down to this sort of triangle. So, you know, one edge of the triangle, you've got organizations who are trying to find problems to solve. You know, they develop an innovative culture, they try to find a problem to solve, and then they go off and ideate that. You know, on the other side of the triangle, you've got exponential technology that you increasingly use in different ways and different combinations to create next generation products and services. And there are over 450 very powerful technologies that we see today that each have their own category, by the way, rather than like AI, a bit of a better AI, some different AI. You know, when I talk about 450 exponential technologies, AI is one of those technologies. 3D printing is another one of those technologies. Nanotech is another one, you know, that kind of stuff. And then at the base of the pyramid, we've actually got, you know, we've found our problem to solve. We've created our next generation product. We want to get it into the market space. And that's really sort of, you know, where we're talking about global culture, societal trends and behaviors. We're talking about network effects. We're talking about everything from liability, regulation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's the world is changing at an increasingly furious rate, basically. And sort of what we see on the Best Buy shelves, that's only the snowflake on the very tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I always, because, so I'm 16 right now, and as I said, I'm a sophomore in high school, and I know each generation kind of has their own thing where, like, as they're growing up, like, things are progressing, things are changing, and they always feel like they're on the cusp of that. But I've been talking to, like, some of my friends who are around the same age, and I'm just like, I remember being, like, 4 and playing on, like, my dad's BlackBerry, and I used to, like send emails on like the super chunky computers. And in the past 10 years, things have just like kind of exponentially progressed, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, the technology that you are born into is generally your generation status quo. So for example, if you have a look at the millennial generation, you know, banks went out a long time ago, basically to sort of go and hire any and every millennial that they could find because, you know, they knew about smart devices and they knew about social media and kind of the digital world. Yeah, my kids, I say, are 8 and 6. And, you know, their status quo from a technology standpoint is increasingly digital humans, avatars and bots, conversational artificial intelligence, behavioral computing, where they talk to the computers to get them to do whatever it happens to be, AI, VR, AR, and mixed reality as well, you know, as well as things like 3D printing. You know, my son, Caden, he wants to start a car company. And from his point of view, he's not talking about starting a traditional car company. He's talking about, you know, how do we get an artificial intelligence to design a car that you can then 3D print? You know, and when you have a look at these generational leaps, you know, within the space of really sort of not even one generation, we've gone from social media and smartphones to that. Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah.
And we're accelerating all the time through generations now. You know, hence sort of the popular phrase that, you know, to a toddler, a book is just a broken iPhone or a broken iPad, rather.
Yeah, that's an interesting phrase. I've never heard that one before. Can you tell us a little bit about like how you got started in this and like, how did you know it was kind of your passion?
Yeah, so I've always had a passion for the future. I've always had a passion for science and technology. And my background is marine biology and oceanography. So I kind of started out my career actually being a park ranger. You know, I'd be doing everything basically from, you know, planning conservation efforts, basically with the UNHCR kind of out in Belize, especially in the Caribbean and sort of Asia Pac. But ended up sort of falling into technology and ended up working for quite a number of the Fortune 100 organizations. The big tech companies. So organizations like EMC, IBM, those kinds of guys. And what continued to amaze me basically within those organizations is even though there are kind of two types of disruption. There's a disruption that your business undergoes because you never saw it coming and it sideswiped you. There's the type of disruption that you see coming, but you don't do anything about it until it's too late and it's disrupted you. And when you have a look at the large majority of most of the sort of traditional technology giants, yeah, they kind of fit into that latter bucket. You know, when you have a look at IBM, IBM kind of saw AWS and Amazon, you know, AWS, coming into this sort of new cloud space, but they moved very late. So from IBM's perspective, I see they made tens of thousands of people redundant because the new world of digital and cloud didn't really gel very well, basically, with the old world of, you know, stack it high, sell it expensive, you know, things like, you know, a traditional on-premise mainframe data center and all these kinds of other things. You know, software that you'd sort of buy and you download rather than software as a service. And as a result of all of this, you know, from my experience, I've seen so many people made redundant by so many organizations because they were disrupted for either one of those two reasons. Mm-hmm. And the people basically who are made redundant, on the one hand, you know, some of them lost their entire livelihoods. Yeah. You know, some of them ultimately, you know, didn't make it, shall we say. Let's just put it that way without going into any particular nasty details. Mm-hmm. And when you look at these organizations, they always sort of have two choices. You know, if you can see the future coming, you can either make everyone redundant and then just rehire for the new thing, or you can take your existing employees with you and take them on your journey. So you kind of, it's kind of retraining incarnate. But the status quo for the vast majority of organizations mean that when they are disrupted, they do the former. You know, they fire everybody and then they rehire for the new thing. Mm-hmm. And that just seems nonsensical. So I got into doing this because, basically, on the one hand, I see the potential in everybody. You know, I do a lot of work throughout Africa, particularly with a number of the schools down there. And everybody has a huge amount of potential within them. You know, if we can take a child, basically, who is sitting next to an open sewer down in Africa, and we can put them into the right environment, and those children can then end up becoming engineers who actually, ironically, work for companies like IBM and Boeing mm-hmm. and NASA and all these other sort of organizations. So in other words, if we can take somebody who is sitting by an open sewer that you'd ask the question, you know, what's your future? And they'd say, mm-hmm. we have no future. You know, if we're lucky, basically in 10 years time, basically we'll die by this open gutter. If you can take somebody that fundamentally has no future, put them into the right environment, you know, with the right resources, the right mentorship programs, the right, you know, sort of educational sort of frameworks and initiatives and those sorts of things, and actually give them a future, then you can do that for anybody, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think has been lost on a lot of organizations today, is that, you know, when you have a look at human capital, the vast majority of organizations seriously underestimate the ability of their own employees to adapt and actually embrace change and actually do some really great things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of interesting how you talk about, well, let me rephrase that. To me, when I think of like the future and futurism, I mostly consider like climate change and space travel and things like that. And it's very interesting to me how you've taken kind of that idea and incorporated it into like the marketplace and different businesses. And it's very smart the way that you, they do that. So. Yeah.
Well, there's someone sort of told me years and years ago, basically, that, you know, the most powerful thing in the world is an idea mm-hmm. because it can proliferate like crazy and you can't kill it. And so if you can either put together an idea, come up with an idea, basically, and you can hit the right dials, yeah, you can achieve almost anything. I mean, you know, take for a good example of this, basically, is science fiction. You know, over in the 1960s, you know, if you have a look at the Star Trek episodes, for example, you know, the directors of the time came up with things like, you know, holograms and holodecks and tractor beams and teleporters and all these sorts of things. Yeah, the fact basically that they kind of came up with this idea of, you know, holograms basically in 3D space all of a sudden meant that it kicked off a generation of engineers who thought, well, why can't we make that, you know? Yeah. And then how do we make that? And so, you know, so much so basically that every single thing that you think of as science fiction is now science fact. You know, you want hoverboards, mm-hmm. I've got videos of hoverboards. You want holograms, and you want me to show you videos of people streaming basically their thoughts to YouTube via brain machine interfaces using artificial intelligence. I've got that, you know, et cetera. Yeah. So you want replicators, 3D printing and holographic printing systems. We've got all that. But again, it sort of kind of comes down to that, you know, I've got an idea. and then actually putting it into the right, well, giving it the right environment, and you can unleash all manner of interesting things.
Yeah. That was a pretty good segue as well into one other topic that I want to talk about, that I mentioned earlier with like AI and the creativity. So I know you talked to my dad, Neil Kane, a few weeks ago, because he's another mentor here at the Mentor Project.
Yeah.
With that in mind, I am a huge Marvel fan, especially the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And so he told me that you kind of mentioned that as like technology progresses, Marvel and other animation like studios will be able to just kind of click a button and type an action into the computer, and it'll be able to create a whole new character with a whole new storyline and background. And it's very hard for me to wrap my mind around the fact that AI can like simulate human creativity that well. So I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that and how that would work.
Yeah, sure. So human creativity, on the one hand, is a process. Anything that is a process that you can break into a workflow, you know, step one, step two, step three, you can generally then turn those steps into algorithms. You can then put those into an artificial intelligence model, and there you go. You know, a good example of that is things like equities trading, IPOs. You know, IPOs is a 160-step process. You know, if you understand those processes and procedures, basically then you can bake them into an algo. So, you know, when we have a look at, for example, human creativity, we like to think basically that it is actually, it can't be replicated. You know, we like to think that it's kind of this ethereal thing, this magical thing, basically, that, you know, has no equal anywhere in the universe. Mm-hmm. But to give you a sort of little example, let's say innovation. We'll take an iterative example of innovation. If I gave you a can and I said, I would like you to innovate that can, I would like you to make it half the weight. In your mind, you're going through a series of steps. You know, you're thinking, well, I can cut the can in half. I can make it from material that is lighter, half as thick. I could make the can smaller. You know, you're going through all these individual steps. Mm-hmm. And as you go through each of these individual steps, because you understand what I mean by the statement, you know, make this can half as heavy. So you have the ability to reason, and you understand the context of my request, which is a very difficult thing for artificial intelligence. You can decide which one of those steps would work and which ones don't. You know, so if you cut the can in half, for example, that probably won't work because cans need lids. If you make it out of a really thin material, then actually it might burst, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So by turning this innovation system into a process, I can get an artificial intelligence to copy that process. So these creative machine, these creative artificial intelligences are typically called creative machines. You can call them by different names. There's generative design. There's generative adversarial networks. They're used by companies like NASA, General Motors, Airbus. They're used by companies like InSilico. They're used by companies like Google to help innovate the next generation of artificial intelligence, chipsets, drugs, vehicles, lunar rovers. Airbus are actually using them to help them design the next A330neo, sort of, you know, intercontinental plane. So we can take innovation and we can turn it into a process. You know, have a look at any innovation consultancy. They will always tell you innovation is a process. Start here, end up here. We can clone that. Now, when we start talking about Marvel, this is sort of where we start getting into some interesting areas, because when you have a look at a Marvel movie, firstly, it's digital. You know, you view it on a screen. The fact that you view it on a screen means that what you are watching on a screen is just a collection of pixels, and what you're hearing is just a collection of different sound waves. So from a machine's perspective, they need to understand that if I put this pixel here, this pixel here, this pixel here, it looks like a character. So we've got a whole variety of different ways that we can create increasingly synthetic movies, books, digital humans, digital characters, digital backdrops, digital synthetic imagery, you know, think deepfakes on steroids, all that sort of stuff. But from an AI, to get to the point basically where I can say to a machine, create a Marvel blockbuster, firstly, it has to know, what do you mean by that? You know, what is Marvel? What's a blockbuster? So we can train that. Secondly, it's kind of got to figure out, well, okay, if I'm going to create a blockbuster exactly like a human, you know, what's the storyline? You know, what's the storyline? What's the plot? An artificial intelligence, to get to the point where we can create an artificially intelligent movie, the AI has got to know how to create a script. It's got to know that this stuff goes at the start of the script, this stuff goes in the middle, and this goes at the end. It's got to know its audience, you know, it's got to, which is a demographic and big data problem. It's got to understand basically things like tempo and intonation, because it knows that a blockbuster is going to be 2 hours and you can't just cram the entire plot line into the first 2 minutes, because that'd be pointless. It's got to understand how to develop character personalities. It's got to understand how those characters might speak. You know, where are they from? What are their accents like? What languages do they talk? You know, what do they look like? You know, it's got to understand, you know, what vehicles are. You know, for example, if you've got a Marvel movie and the artificial intelligence decides that it wants to put a horse and cart in there, that's probably the wrong thing to stick in there. It's got to understand what the backdrops look like. It's got to understand what perspective looks like. It's got to understand how the characters relate with one another, how they relate with the audience. Yeah, there's huge amounts of things that they need to do. But where we are at the moment, basically with synthetic media, is we can use artificial intelligence to create synthetic music. And those are now so good that Sony and Warner Brothers have actually hired the AI pop musicians and pop stars and pop.
Wow.
That make that. So that's a fun one. They're getting hired. Secondly, we've got AIs basically that are able to produce high resolution images. So these are platforms like NVIDIA Gauguin, for example, basically where, you know, you look at the images they produce and you can't tell it's not a real photo. You know, it's high def. In fact, it's actually better than a real photo. We've got synthetic characters. So those are just your traditional sort of characters. Now, we can either use those, we can create those in a manner of different ways. We can use things like the Unreal Engines and Epic Engines, or we can actually just use an artificial intelligence to create a neural network based digital human. So these are platforms like Synthesia. Soul Machines is kind of one of my favorites. They're sort of a good example of what we can do basically with AIs that are able to create characters. You've got Digi Doug from Imagination. So Digi Doug is quite a good example. Have a look at him. He's actually an artificial intelligent character with its own neural network brain that has, that you can see pretty much all of him as well. Because most AIs are here. They can do the kind of head and the top body, but they're not too good at, you know, legs, hands, you know, arm gestures, that sort of stuff. Then we've got sort of, you know, synthetic virtual effects. So we've got what we call Foley. So we have artificial intelligences that can create different sort of Foley effects. And then we've got synthetic text. Synthetic text is important. So these platforms like OpenAI with their GPT-3 model. Synthetic text is important because that's kind of your script. And if you can put a script together, we then have finally synthetic video, which is just as it sounds. So that's artificial intelligences that are creating synthetic video. So that's from, for example, DeepMind, OpenAI again, Google are doing that as well, NVIDIA are doing that. And then we've got synthetic VR and virtual worlds. But this is sort of where, once you've got a piece of synthetic text, a script, you can then use a text to video generator to start converting that into your video. So Stanford, again, giving examples rather than just sort of talking high level about these things, giving some details. This is where, for example, Stanford University created a text video editor that allows you to text, you know, create a video of a man playing golf. And it will create a video, short video, grainy resolution of a man playing golf. And the reason it can do that is because it's been trained on millions of YouTube videos that are appropriately labeled, and it understands that a man that plays golf looks a bit like this. You know, he holds a stick that looks like this, and he's hitting something white and round that, you know, the AI figures is probably the golf ball. So what you do in order to create a fully synthetic Marvel blockbuster movie, bearing in mind where these AIs are creating horribly crummy, awful movies at the minute, that are about 15 minutes long. All of these different elements have got to come together.
Yeah.
And that's basically sort of, you know, so what we have is we have technology comes together in silos. We've got all these individual pieces of technology. So synthetic text, synthetic audio, you know, synthetic imagery, synthetic video, synthetic, you know, X, Y, and Z. And as we get better at creating all these individual sort of bits of synthetic media, some humans in some places are going, well, you know, how do we combine these together? When they combine, say, for example, synthetic text with synthetic video generators, the result is really horrible and awful. And then what happens is just human ingenuity. They go, well, how do we improve that? And then they improve it. And suddenly, basically, the AI is better able to follow the script. You know, the video that it puts together basically actually looks better. You know, it's higher resolution. It makes more sense, you know. And then they start putting more stuff into it, and it gets better and better and better and better. So from a Marvel blockbuster perspective, I reckon that we're about 15 years away from the point when we can actually say, you know, create a blockbuster. And off we go. But technology development basically is incredibly fast. Technology becomes increasingly performant, accessible, and cheap. And if you have a look at deepfakes, you know, I'd encourage anyone to have a look at the Tom Cruise TikTok deepfake. Think about this, you know, to create that took about $300, and it fools most people. 5 to 6 years ago, if you wanted to create a deep fake, you would have had to have been at Stanford University. You would have had to have a major in artificial intelligence, deep learning, and machine learning. You'd generally be paid about $1 to $1.2 million, maybe a little bit more. Wow. And you'd have had to have a team of about 5 to 10 of you. And at the end of that, you'd have created a deep fake that looked absolutely horrible, rubbish, and crummy, and everyone would laugh at you. Now, if you want to create a deep fake, download the Chinese Zhao app or Reface. Take a picture of yourself. You don't even have to scan your face. And you are now in a movie. Off. It's free. It's democratized. It's accessible. Basically. And actually, the quality, even on this free stuff, is actually good enough that you're going to want to share it and say, look at the movie that I was just in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we sort of say, you know, when it comes to creating when it comes to artificial intelligence being used to exclusively and autonomously create a blockbuster Marvel movie, it's lots of things. And then as for the blockbuster, one of the sort of questions I tend to get asked is, how does an AI know what good is? You know, so we've had artificial intelligence, and again, example here is IBM Watson. So if I said to anybody, go and create an award-winning or a blockbuster advert movie thing, if they didn't really have the experience, the first thing they would do is they would go to Google and punch in award-winning adverts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they would look at all of the award-winning adverts, and in their head they would try, you know, say, for example, it's a car advert. They'd look at it and go, well, all of the award-winning car adverts, you know, have got presence. They've got this type of tempo. They've got this kind of scenery. They've got this type. They use this type of music, you know, this type of car from this type of angle. We do exactly the same with artificial intelligence. So, and this is being applied to the A&R industry. Artificial intelligence is also being used to pick future blockbusters like this. And what it will do is, we train these models on what good looks like because we will feed them what's good. So, for example, in the A&R industry, if you want to figure out as a record producer or as a label, you know, what the future hits are, you feed these AIs all of the past hits, you know, and you know, like the Billboard charts in the US and the top 40 charts in the UK. And the AI will start clumping stuff together, and it'll go all of the number one hits. You know, the biggest number of number one hits were females, single vocalists, singing about love. Therefore, if I want to create a number one pop hit, it should probably, I should probably have a female voice singing about love at this kind of speed with this kind of instrumentation. It's exactly like that. And so it's incredibly difficult to do. But the theory behind it isn't actually rocket science. And so what we do is, if you want to teach an artificial intelligence what a Marvel blockbuster looks like, you feed it Marvel blockbusters and it starts figuring out what makes them all so good. It comes out with commonalities and go, the ones that had the biggest box office returns included the metaverse. They included these characters. These characters were doing this kind of plot, you know, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was roughly this length. This was the audience that it targeted, et cetera, et cetera. And then it uses that information of what good looks like to create the script. And then once it's got the script, you know, so for example, IBM Watson created a script for a Lexus advert, which you can go and have a look at. And actually that became an award-winning advert. Wow. So it creates a script and then you try to use different artificial intelligence, what we call general adversarial network generators, which is a type of AI, to go and produce the imagery and the noise that's associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very involved process. I definitely have a better understanding of it now, because originally I was like, it just doesn't seem possible.
This is where at the moment, you know, you're absolutely right. This is a highly involved process. You know, if you were a human researcher and you wanted to create a Marvel blockbuster, to be honest, you got to spend tens of millions of dollars. You've got to be incredibly hands-on. You know, you're going to pull your hair out. You know, you've got to have big teams with lots of resources and everything else. But as all of these different technologies mature, as they are combined together, as we find ways to automate all of these different tasks, eventually we get to the point basically where you just say to an AI, just as we see with robo programmers today, basically like, you know, the likes of Microsoft DeepCoder, Google Bayou, where you can just talk to a system and say, build me an application, build me a movie, and it will go off and it will build you the movie. So we eventually get to the point basically where all this stuff is automated, you know, just like the Zao app, basically where I take a photo and I just choose the movie I want to be in. That's it. But to get to that point took 6 years and hundreds of millions of dollars of other people's research.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all for that. thank you for that information. That was very interesting. We're a bit over time, but my last quick question is if anyone wants to learn more about you or any of your companies, where can they go to?
I'm on YouTube. You can have a look at my keynotes on YouTube, and that'll give you a really quick preview basically into the future. And the future is nuttier, crazier, and more sci-fi like than you think. Alternatively, you can go to my website. So that's 311institute.com. I've got loads of free reports and freebies. There's some of 3,000 different sort of innovations and articles on 450 exponential technologies. And frankly, basically, you can literally get lost basically on the site. And then, of course, basically, you can reach me on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. I try to be social when time allows. And if anyone's got any questions, literally just, I would say email me, but that actually sounds a little bit old fashioned now. That's it. I don't know. Telepathy exists, by the way. So you can communicate with me telepathically. And if you can find that out, then I'll buy you a coffee. And finding out how to do human telepathy, frankly, just search the site for telepathy and you'll figure that one out. It's fairly easy. Go to the website, mooch about. There's loads and loads of stuff from, you know, podcasts and videos and bite-sized series and the whole lot. So all over the place.
All right. That's very exploring. Good to know. All right. This has been so interesting and so much fun. Thank you so much to our guest, and thank you to everyone who's listening. I hope you all found that very compelling and learned as much as I did. If you want to learn more about Matthew himself, feel free to go to all of the places he mentioned. If you want to learn more about the Mentor Project, you can go to mentorproject.org. Now that is mentorproject.org, and learn more about us. I hope to see you all back here next week. Thank you so much to our listeners and sponsors for making this podcast possible. We appreciate everything you do.